And I'm so happy to be talking with Joe Henry tonight, right before you go on stage. Are you excited about the show?
Always.
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 Do you have a set list planned?
We have a set list sketched out. You know, we have a shape of the evening, but things change as we go along.
Sometimes. You're flexible.
Try to be flexible all the time.
I listened to your new album, and Light No Lamp When the Sun Comes Down just knocked me out and almost made me cry. It's really beautiful.
Well,
can
thank
you. Tell me what the inspiration was?
I was reading a lot of really, really old... I was reading an old anthology of... the Anthology of American Negro Poetry that was published originally in 1960. And a lot of the stuff that's in there dates back to the Civil War era and before. And there was something about the language tonality that reads like a spiritual, but is not so specifically necessarily rooted in church. I think I was just really sort of riffing on that kind of cadence, that kind of language that sounds introspective, and at the same time, I was writing very consciously, playing with that same kind of word tonality, like I was saying, that feels rooted in spiritual but is not church-specific. It's introspective, it's aware in the world, but, you know, I hope that it's modern and, you know, or, well, I should say the goal is to be timeless, not timely. You know, nothing ages worse than something that's completely rooted in the, you know, present moment and references, current affairs and that kind of thing. I try to stay away from that. But there's something about that kind of language that really appeals to me that I find emotional.
It did feel very emotional, as I said. And so when you talk about language tonality, can you just elaborate on that for a sec? Because I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
Well, sometimes I just mean the physical sounds of words direct me. I don't work so much as having a specific idea or a subject and then decide, I'm going to write about it. I find out what I'm writing about by writing. And frequently, the thing that gets me going is the physical sounds of words. You know, rhythm of words, how they feel coming out of your mouth. Sometimes I write things that I know would work as a poem, but wouldn't work as a song, because there's nothing inherently musical about certain words to me. So I just find myself directed by, you know, what language sounds like.
Do you feel inspired? Like, is there a song that you've ever written that really you felt just took you over, that just completely took you over?
Well, all the best ones. I mean, all the ones that I continue to like at some point, even if it was a song that I wrote very quickly, you know, was an obsession in that moment. You know, you always find out later, sometimes it'll surprise you, the songs that you don't go back to versus the ones that you just, that continue to offer something, you know. I mean, I've made 11 records of my own to date, I guess. I don't go back, as far as playing live, I don't typically go back much before Trampoline in my catalog, which was 96. Not because I don't think there are good songs back there, but I think my writing got more open. They feel more expansive to me, and they feel more specific at the same time. I just think I got better. I'm not stubborn. I just, you know, especially songs on the new record, because they're sort of riffing on blues structure. Not a blues record by any stretch, but playing consciously with blues structure as a form. The songs feel really open to me.
And the music as when it falls behind the lyrics, or does it fall behind the lyrics, or do they come together at the same time?
It happens every which way. I mean, my favorite songs are the ones when they sort of arrive intact. But that's not always true. I mean, I'm a very word-oriented person. Yet I frequently, as a listener, respond to things that are not word-specific. As a writer, that is my point of entry. And I sometimes, if I'm working on a piece of music, I will try to develop it and yet leave enough holes in it so that, depending on what the words need it to do, you know, there's enough raw fabric there to tailor it a bit, as opposed to the other way around.
Wow. Yeah, well, your songs have such depth. And speaking also about your new recording, your son has some involvement,
I think. He's on half of it, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, he's 18. He's at his first year of college. He's studying jazz at the New School in New York City.
Oh, my goodness. You must be so proud.
I am, but it's a learning curve, you know, him being out of the house.
Yeah.
He's actually joining this tour when we get to New York. He's playing, and then his spring break begins, so he's playing with us in New York, and then he's playing through the Midwest with us.
Oh, my goodness. You're playing the Blue Note in New York?
Yes, we are.
Oh, that's going to be fantastic.
It should be great. As a matter of fact, the gentleman who's opening the show tonight, Dana Stevens, is a fantastic modern tenor player that my son turned me on to. My son has actually studied with him some. Dana has lived in New York, and he's from the Bay Area.
Right.
But he and my son have friends in common, and when he's come through L.A. a few times in the last couple of years, my son has studied with him. So I've been turned onto a lot of newer jazz musicians because of my son. He listens to everything.
And is that why you invited Dana to
Yeah.
Oh, that's super.
Yeah.
That's...
Well, we've had this idea for this tour where we have rehearsed and we played the first two shows just as a trio, myself and the rhythm section. But from here out, everywhere we are going, there's somebody coming through a revolving door to add to it. Tonight, our good friend Patrick Warren is playing keyboards, who I record with all the time, but he's not traveling with us. He just came up for the day because he had a baby 1 week ago, and I think he wanted to get out of the house. And I thought it would be great to have Dana open the show because I think he's a wonderful composer and great player, and then I thought, well, if he's here, he should come through the revolving door. So from here out, wherever we go, it'll be a different cast that comes in and infiltrates this trio that's the nucleus of, you know, sound.
Of the Joe Henry experience.
Yeah, well, of the moment, yeah.
Of the moment. What have been the people that you've enjoyed to work with? I know you've worked with some of my favorite people, which is what made me so thrilled about talking with you, because Solomon Burke is one of my all-time mm-hmm. favorites, as is Elvis Costello, of uh-huh. course. Who have been some of the luminaries that you've really enjoyed working with?
Well, there's different kinds of enjoyment, Linda, you know? I mean, there have been projects that have just been tremendous fun. Not that they weren't also hard work, but joyful. I've done a lot of work with Loudon Wainwright III, who was a hero to me when I was a teenager first writing songs. And we did a lot of work together just a couple years ago. We scored a film together, the film Knocked Up. The songs we wrote together for that became his album called Strange Weirdos, and then we did a project together right after called Recovery. Working with Loudon, just a complete joy to me. He's a great friend, and I admire him tremendously. I think he's savagely underrated. I have a very unique relationship with Alan Toussaint. We've had five different projects to date, and that continues to mystify me when I find myself in his service. You know, because he has for a long time been, you know, the producer's producer and the songwriter's songwriter, and you know, to find myself working in that capacity for him is shocking to me. It always a complete revelation to be around him. He's not like anybody else I know in this world.
Well, I thought it was so serendipitous that he was just here two nights ago, and I was about to come to that show, and I unfortunately didn't make it, and then here you come two days later.
And we're both in L.A. tomorrow night, which is tough because I won't be able to see his show, nor will he be able to join in mine. But I just was working with him again in New York a few weeks ago on behalf of a film soundtrack that I'm working on, where I wrote a new song and recorded it with Solomon Burke, who I had not seen in 5 years or so. I worked with Little Jimmy Scott. I shouldn't call him Little anymore. He's 84, for God's sake. That was absolutely magical. Jimmy Scott was... he's always had a voice and a presence like somebody not quite of this world, but it really was like working with somebody who was only half in this world and halfway into the next already. It was amazing. I made a record with Mose Allison that's coming out in a couple weeks. He's 82. That was great. I've just started working on a sort of a pair of projects. I don't know where they're going to go. With Harry Belafonte, who turned 83 on Monday, who is one of the most remarkable people I've ever been in a room with. We were just traveling in Europe together for 2 weeks, Berlin and Paris and London, about 4 days in each place, researching a film documentary he wants to make. about violence in the world, about the hip-hop community, and how that music has been co-opted from something very positive to something he regards as very negative. That's one aspect that we're developing. That's been a very unique relationship. I had a chance 2 years ago to work with the great singer from Mali, Salif Keita, and that was mind-bending to me. Somebody like me who's so word-oriented, to be working with a singer, one of the great singers alive, one of the most powerful singers I've ever been around, who doesn't sing in English at all, and yet I was crying all the time. I mean, just weeping all the time. First, I thought it was because I was tired, because I had just come from making The Bright Mississippi with Alan Toussaint in New York. Really intense. Fantastic, but an intense 4 days. Then flew to Paris, and there we were, in Salif's world. But I just found him, as a singer, incredibly emotional. It didn't matter whether I understood the words or not. So that in itself was a really interesting lesson for me about the way words work and the way that sound can sometimes completely supersede text.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. That's, yes, something I feel very strongly about. Who would you like to work with that you haven't, perhaps?
Boy. Sonny Rollins. I've done a lot of work with Brad Meldow, the great jazz pianist, on my own things, but I'd like to work on a record with Brad. Bill Withers, Doc Watson, Prince. Those are a few.
Those are nice. I like that selection. And I like how you just kind of pulled them out.
I give this some thought, Linda.
Well, okay, I see.
You have to imagine
you think
it.
Quickly.
You have to imagine it for it to ever happen.
It's true.
You imagine something and you start walking towards it.
That's so nice. That would be a good wrap-up question, but we're not done yet because you know, I just have like a lot. Mm. What's on your iPod?
Oh boy, a lot of things. What do I listen to? Right now, I've been sort of obsessing over listening to a lot of kind of pop folk music from the late 60s, just the production of it has intrigued me, you know, whether it's, early Neil Young or Tom Rush or Judy Collins or Joni Mitchell and Fairport Convention. I don't know why, I haven't really paid that, Simon and Garfunkel, I haven't paid that stuff much attention in a long time, but I find myself, for some reason, traveling right now, very fascinated by it. I have to say that when I go back to music for nourishment, and not because I have to work on something or I'm supposed to listen to something, I'm listening to the same records I've been listening to for 30 years, you know? Thelonious Monk, Duke Ellington all the time, wow. Charlie Parker all the time, every day, really early Louis Armstrong, Lester Young, that kind of stuff.
I guess that answers my other question, which was rock or jazz.
Well, I've never regarded myself as a rock person, even though I've listened to a lot of rock music. I love a lot of rock music. I just don't, on my own accord, I don't think in terms of genre, you know? When I first heard Monk when I was 15, it completely turned my head around, but I don't think it occurred to me to think that, okay, now I'm listening to jazz. I just knew that whoever he was mattered to me. Like when I first saw a Fellini movie, I just knew that it mattered. I didn't think about, okay, now I'm watching foreign movies. I just thought, whatever this is, I'm interested. I listen to a lot of really old country blues music. Blind Willie McTell, almost every day at some point. Any playlist I make has Blind Willie McTell on it. Reverend Gary Davis, Robert Johnson, always Robert Johnson. You know, Lightnin' Hopkins, Lead Belly, things like that. You know, and I still play Astro Weeks all the time.
Really?
Sure, that's one of my favorite records.
Wow.
Because it's a complete hallucination, you know? I mean, it's a sustained hallucination to me. It's like a Joyce, you know, it's like the Dubliners to me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What, when you said it something about the production values, I think, about the early 60s music, I was going to ask you, how has technology sort of changed the way the sound, when you go into the recording studio, how do you feel it has changed over the past 20, 30 years?
Well, one of the biggest changes is that recording engineers don't necessarily learn how to record people live in a room. You know, when you have three, if you have three people playing in this room right now, there's the sound that everybody's producing, and then there's all the harmonic overtone and crosstalk between instruments that just becomes weather in the room. And when engineers want to isolate everything, record everything in a vacuum, and then sort of recreate ambience with reverbs and delays and all that kind of thing. There's, if you don't know how to take the picture with all that smoke in the air, something is diminished. And recording engineers in the 50s, you go back and listen to those great Sinatra records. I listen to Sinatra all the time, too. Engineers who really understood balance between instruments and the, a lot of why the piano sounds like it does is how it's bleeding into the drum mic on the side of the room. So I think a lot of people have not learned how to do that because we got into some idea, because there's so many tracks, you don't have to make decisions about how to submix things onto four tracks. Everything has its own track, thus everything needs to be isolated, and then I think something is lost. It's like eight people, meeting for dinner and all eating in a separate room,
Wow, that's extreme. But I think that is telling because maybe it has to do with why your albums are so beautifully produced. Because there's a sound that you want, like on the Bright Mississippi, which is absolutely brilliant and very evocative. And the sound is so rich. Maybe that's something that you consciously try.
Oh, sure. We went into a big room in New York and I just said, look, Alan, so readily disappears into the sidelines. He's so bashful about being the center. I said, I want to put the piano in the middle of the room. I just want to put musicians in a circle around him. I don't want any people in separate rooms. We just use baffles and whatever. And we had an engineer who knew how to do that. I said, every time Alan walks back into the room, I want him to recognize himself at the center of the room. And everybody just stood in a circle. And he drums everything.
So everybody was eating in the same room.
Yeah, everybody was eating in the same room at the same table. But I work in L.A. with an engineer religiously named Ryan Freeland. He didn't do Bright Mississippi because it was in New York and it just wasn't cost effective to bring. Plus, Kevin Killen is brilliant who did that record. But all the work I do, for the most part, I work with this young man named Ryan Freeland, who's a musician first, and he's very musical, and he's in love with that sonic weather I described a moment ago, and he knows how to take that picture. So.
What's been your most proud achievement of the past year?
Of the past year? Well, a couple weeks ago, Ramblin' Jack Elliott won a Grammy for a record that I produced with him, and that was incredibly gratifying because he's somebody that matters to so many of us. And he trusted me. I created a project, and I picked all the music and put all these people around him. And when you ask somebody to do that, you hope that they get to the end of it and think it was worth doing, rather than saying, "See, I told you I don't want to do that." So that was very gratifying to see Jack acknowledged that way.
Congratulations.
Thank you. That was very meaningful. Doing something with Moe's, who had sworn off making records a dozen years ago or something. People, I've been listening to Moe's since I was a teenager, so to be able to offer him something back, here's a platform and I found and here's a label who will pay for it. Just offering opportunity to people that we all find meaningful, that's wildly gratifying.
Yeah. And it must just touch you so deeply to have these artists whom you love.
Yeah.
To you.
Whatever I'm doing with Harry right now has been strangely gratifying. Now, I don't yet know how to quantify what that is or what it will become. Just my time in his company and in his service is just really, really, quite unusual and surprisingly validating to me,
I'm a big fan of his as well, and my mother and I went and saw him, and I've been listening to him ever since I was a child, because my mother played him,
mother.
Really?
Wherever I go.
Everybody says the same thing.
Well, and people respond to him in such a particular sort of a way, So those are things that just come to mind when you ask, I guess.
Thank you. Yeah, those are great. All right, we just have a couple. Just have a couple more. Would you ever sample in doing a song? Would you ever sample anybody?
Oh, sure. I'm not a purist by any stretch. I think whatever makes something meaningful come out of a pair of speakers is completely fair game. I would sample anything. I would, I would tune something. I would fly it around. I would cut it up. I just happen to like what happens when people play music together in real time. But once that happens, once that's our template, if I hear that, hey, that's great, but if we cut that ending under there, because that take was a crash and burn, but there was an unbelievable fraying fabric at the end of it that I find really interesting. Let's cut that onto it. You know, whatever works. I've sampled things on my record Fuse. There's a I shouldn't say it because I don't think I paid for any of them.
Oh, go ahead.
My Dizzy Gillespie, Ray Charles sample in there. Like Bing Crosby talking off some TV show.
Oh, I love that.
I can't remember. It's been a while now. I had tried to get Dr. Dre to produce that record, and I couldn't get him to meet with me. So when I began making Fuse, you know, I did what you do. So I tried to imagine, okay, well, he won't work with me. How do I think he operates? And of course, you try to do that. You never go in his direction. You go off into something else. But I was certainly directed by trying to imagine how that music gets made. And I started, you know, with loops and playing everything myself and building, not solos, but when something needed to happen, I would, you know, use samples to create kind of sound effects. And then I would replace things with other musicians as I went on. But my daughter was an infant at the time, and I made that whole record in the garage with a baby monitor on when she was napping. Sometimes I work 2 hours at a stretch, sometimes I work 15 minutes at a stretch. All good, Paul. Thank you.
Let's see. What do you have any favorites for the awards? Any music choices for the Academy Awards?
I don't even know what's up. Okay. Well, I take that back. My very dear friend, my mentor, T-Bone Burnett, has music up, and, you know, I've learned more from T-Bone than I would know how to quantify. So yeah, that's my favorite.
Did you know Steven?
I did.
Yeah.
He was a champ. He was a champion.
Have you seen Crazy Heart?
I have seen it.
Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah, it was really moving.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And,
particularly for you.
I think Jeff's gonna have his moment. If I was a betting man, I think he's gonna have his moment.
I hope so.
It's not my favorite performance of it necessarily, but you know, people aren't always acknowledged for the thing that was actually their great performance. Though it's a fantastic performance, but I think there's a groundswell of interest in seeing him getting acknowledged.
Exactly. Nashville or Austin?
Oh boy, neither. I've had very lovely times in both places, but I mean, if I had to choose, I won't choose. No, I wouldn't live in either place. Thank you.
Okay. Where do you call home?
Los Angeles. Yeah. Well, South Pasadena, which is about 5 minutes, literally 5 minutes due east of downtown Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Very old community, and you kind of feel like you've left town without leaving town.
Nice. Scrabble or Boggle?
Scrabble, for sure. We play a lot of Scrabble at my house. I'm terrible. I have really good words, but they don't add up to anything.
You, the wordsmith.
Well, like I said, I come up with beautiful words, but I don't think in terms of how to score points. I just try to make nice words, and my wife and my son eat me alive.
Anybody that you dislike in the world?
No. Well, if I do, it's my inclination to ask myself what my problem is. I try to make a decision to be non-judgmental. I'm not always successful. There are people I have disliked, and I try to tell myself, you know, that behavior that is that doesn't display the better parts of its humanity typically comes out of fear, and I try to remind myself that, you know, Dick Cheney, for example, is just he's afraid. He's not evil. He's just afraid, and I try to have some compassion for that.
That was actually my next thing.
You know, I still might tackle him in a hotel lobby if I saw him, but I don't necessarily think that'd be the right thing to do.
Karl Rove or Dick Cheney was going to be my next. Yeah.
You put them. They should go to live together in Nashville. That's what I think.